Group meeting, Sunday, 26th October, 1986. I will reread the last paragraph which completed the previous meeting in September. The great secret, the hidden mystery, the inmost esoteric truth of the spiritual realization which is the ineffable communion, is the silence. And all the utterances of Scripture culminate in and dissolve into the silence. This silence is the great peace, the peace of God which passeth all understanding, the peace to which Jesus referred when he said, "Peace I leave with you, my peace I give unto you. Not as the world giveth, give I unto you." This silence is the nirvana of the Buddha, the other shore to which one has crossed over, the samadhi of the Buddhist and the Hindu, the meditation of Krishnamurti, the secret yoga sleep of the Upanishads, particularly Upanishads like the Varaha and the Mandala Brahmana. These two Upanishads are misclassed amongst minor Upanishads. There is nothing minor about them. They are extremely profound and very instructive, because the Varaha particularly gives you the key, the main key to understand the so-called principal Upanishads in depth. This silence is the pristine, timeless state of unconditioned mind. Mysteriously, it contains the movement of the disturbed mind, the maya, the illusion, which is spatio-temporal existence. The realization of this silence is therefore no escape whatsoever from the storm and stress of the stage show of reality. It is the whole and perfect being in communion. Now, this silence is the beginning, if one may use that word, as well as the end point where human evolution is concerned. It's rather interesting how people have had the sensitivity to say that the source and the goal are identical. They are one and the same. Now, this silence, it is out of this silence that the primordial creative energy produces the universe. And it produces it with a big noise, with conflict, confusion, struggle, and so forth. The whole evolutionary process as we know it is the very antithesis of this silence. The evolutionary process as we know it belongs to the manifested universe. it doesn't belong to that aspect of being which is the unmanifested. There are those who have been able to touch that unmanifested, and it is touched in silence, only when the silence supervenes completely. And it is seen then that the whole of the manifested is not exactly an illusion. It is part of reality. I would say definitely it is part of the total reality, but it is illusory. It deceives us human beings as to the true nature of the reality. And also the true nature of the creative energy. For this creative energy holds in potentiality within itself pure consciousness, or pure mind if you like to use that word, and it holds also creative power and fundamental substance. Using the word substance, not in the ordinary dictionary everyday sense of solid matter and so forth, but in the sense of that which underlies, that which stands under, sub under, stands from sto stare to stand. That is substance, that which underlies. So if we look at it that way, we will see that this pure mind or consciousness and the creative power and the fundamental substance are in a state of complete silence, complete peace. That means silence, not only in our ordinary everyday meaning of silence here, not to make a sound, not to make a noise, you see. It means not only that, but it also means that it is in a state of complete peace, of harmony, of order. Order of a kind and a nature which we ordinary humans cannot possibly conceive with our brains. Because, curiously enough, that order, that transcendent order, is also the source of the world disorder. Which brings me to a very important point. The silence, transcendence itself, it contains everything. What we call good, what we call evil, what we call failure, success. In short, it contains all the duals. Birth and death, which we usually think of as life and death, because what we call our life is what follows our birth. And for us, death really means an annihilation. We may have various beliefs. Oh no, the soul, the spirit, the pure mind, the whatever it is the immortal essence of us and so forth. But those are all verbal postulates. They are the result of our mode of conceiving things, and our mode of conceiving things is entirely in dualistic terms only. To start with, we look at ourselves as the observing subject. I am seeing this, I am experiencing this. You see, we start as the subject. And that which we look at, which we contact through the use of our senses, is the object. So this fundamental dualism afflicts what consciousness we have and developed as human animals, human beings as we call ourselves. And it is from that primary dualism, the self and the not-self, the subject, the seeing subject, and the observed object. That is the primary duality from which emerge all the other dualities. The duality of regarding our organism as separate from the environment. I have spoken 1,000 times, if I have said it once, that we regard all objects as something separate, things which are separate from us. And we regard all creatures, including the human creature, as isolated from us. I am I and not somebody else. So that duality between organism and environment comes into being in our life and afflicts our consciousness and the way we see life and the way we behave in consequence. And from that there proceeds another difficulty. The organism doesn't see that birth and death are a simultaneous process for all that exists, all that lives. So we think in terms of life and death. Life actually is eternal, so is death. But it's very, very difficult to see this. We must try, however, to grasp, to get some sort of inkling of its nature, because it will make a very great difference in our practical everyday life. Because it will make a difference in our approach to life. So you see, we cling to life, and we want to continue to live. And we have the fear of death, the fear of this organism being annihilated. But in actuality, our whole living process, and I'm deliberately saying living process, is in the now, the instant, the immediate now. You see? Now, and that now, in the immediate moment, is not the same now as in the previous moment, nor will it be the same now in the succeeding moment. So we have birth and death taking place together in the now, because the moment passes and the next moment is there. Now, birth implies the absence of the past. Whatsoever was past is past. It's not living now. It has produced as a consequence what the now is in terms of manifestation. See, because there is continuous change going on. All right? So that the past produces the now, gives birth to the now, and the now gives birth to the next now. And in order to give birth to the next now, this now dies into the next now, obviously. You see? And death, therefore, means the absence of the future. There is no future where death is concerned. Just as there is no past where birth is concerned, there is no future where death is concerned. Now, it isn't at all easy to really to see these things. And when I say see, I mean see more in the sense in which Krishnamurti meant see, namely to be truly conscious of it. We hear so many words, we may read so many words, and momentarily we may say, ah yes, yes, that sounds sensible, that is so, that is logical, I agree with it. Or it may not sound so sensible, I disagree with it. Or I like it and therefore I agree with it. Or I don't like that sort of philosophy and I disagree with it, you see. Our likes and dislikes interfere with the whole process. But we must try and see the fact as the fact, that birth and death take place simultaneously, because it is that which produces the flow of what we call time. We are conscious of time, but we know time practically only in the material sense of what the clock tells us, the hour of the day, and so forth. Oh, it's time for dinner, or it's time to go out to the meeting, or it's time for this, that, and the other. But the actual flow of time is this movement of the now from birth through death to the next now, and so on. If we become really conscious of it, you will find that neither birth nor death has any hold over you. Life, or rather, birth, death, and the eternal now are one and the same reality. The great mystics of all the faiths, of all societies which have delved into this, have seen that. You see? And once the fear of death can be removed, then so many other anxieties are removed. You see, this terrible angst, those who know German, is that the correct word? Anxiety, what we call anxiety, this terrible anxiety is out. This fear of what's going to happen next now. Now this has happened, now what's going to happen to me and to my dear ones or whatever it is next. Isn't it awful and so on. All that nonsense is clean out of your consciousness. You won't get affected. To a degree, I have seen this for myself, that you remain in a state of peace, of silence. So you see the tremendous significance of this silence. And we have to start, more or less, by learning to be silent, not only in speech, but also in thought and feeling, which means our psychological reaction to what has happened. Pure observation, you will discover that really pure observation will be thoughtless, it will be shapeless. It's our thinking process, which is a talking process, which is the result of the naming process. Adam gave names, and so forth. You see? It is that which causes the noise, which causes the trouble. So, we have to learn to let that calm down. We can't tell our own brains shut up. We can't compel our own brains to shut up. But just be patient with the noise. The silly little fool up here in the top story is making himself, you see. Just be patient with it. Breathe easily. Just live. Life in itself, like eternity and infinity, is silent. It doesn't make a noise. It is manifestation which implies a limitation of that primordial creativeness, the consciousness, the pure mind or consciousness, and the fundamental substance, that is quiet. And that is the point towards which the human race is evolving in consciousness. What may come or may happen when at least a sizable percentage of the human race has realized that, I don't know, of course. But it is likely that nature will produce a new kind of, I can only use the word creature, because being a creature myself, I can't talk in other terms. Look at the way the whole world has, through the ages, talked of God. God is only a creature. In Africa, God is painted black. He's a black man or a black woman. In India, he's a brown man or a brown. You see, these absurdities come into being because we are unaware of the way in which we are deluded by our thought process and our faulty observation. Now, the very fact that we observe creates duality, because we can observe only in terms of, as we are at present, we can observe only in terms of I, the observing subject, looking at the observed object. Isn't that so? There are two. There is a duality, not the ultimate unity. The ultimate unity split into two. You know how in the second chapter of Genesis, Adam, the Lord God caused a sleep to fall upon Adam. He fell asleep, but not sleep in the sense we sleep when we go to bed, dog tired and therefore we sleep soundly. Not like that. This sleep is what the Upanishads call the yoga sleep, the yogic sleep. It comes in the deep meditative states. Adam calls this sleep, God calls this sleep to fall upon Adam, not Adam upon God. And whilst he was asleep, the Lord took a rib, and out of that rib he created woman. I won't spend time trying to explain that in some detail, but it's a tremendous thing actually. Its significance is tremendous. That was the origin, so to say, of the duality which enabled manifestation to go on. Because Adam and Eve created their children and so forth, and the whole lot of us, 5,000 millions today, came on the scene. So you see, that means that the male, female, the positive, negative forms of creative energy brought forth all manifestation. From that one word silence, look what comes out. Yes. But as I have written here, this silence is the pristine, timeless state of unconditioned mind, which mysteriously, to me it's a mystery, it contains the movement of the disturbed mind, the Maya, which is the whole of spatio-temporal existence. How creation brought forth manifestation, the creative energy brought forth manifestation, we don't know. But manifestation does come out of that primordial creative power and energy. So what science has discovered is at the level of material energy and substance. Science knows so much about various forms of energy. What primordial energy is in itself, science doesn't know. But what science has been able to do is to prove definitely now that energy and matter are interconvertible. This is a very important point. We may perhaps analogically conjecture that this primordial creative energy and all manifestation are also interconvertible. In terms of human consciousness and its fulfillment, that is something which the few perfected holy ones throughout the world's history have realized for themselves. You see? But in that realization, and through that realization, there dawns perfect order, peace, wholeness, holiness, health. Those three words, wholeness, holiness, health, are the same thing really. Zarathustra was the first of the monotheistic teachers who brought that out. In the Avestan language it is called Haurvatat. Haurvatat. And immortality is called Ameretat. Ameretat. Not deathfulness. So out of that silence there emerges all this. We seek, and it is of course that peace is the state of supreme happiness. And the Haurvatat is the state of supreme well-being. We don't really know what they imply and mean in terms of our life in the world as human organisms. We are restricted so much by the fact that the human manifests as a psychophysical organism. But the human is something very much profounder and greater than that. Because the human also is actually the creative energy and this creative power and this transcendent consciousness. That is the human, but you'll never find that in any dictionary or anything. And there are very few who have, as far as I'm aware, really emphasized that sort of meaning to the word human. If we, with our limited abilities and our imperfect psyche and mind and consciousness, can begin to get a glimpse of that, if one ray of light even enters into us, it would make all the difference to one's own life. Provided that the ray has taken lodgment. If it hasn't taken lodgment, it just passes out. Like we say, oh, it goes in at one ear and goes out at the other ear, you see. But it must take lodgment in us. And in taking by taking lodgment, there is a complete well, I won't say complete at once, but it is it transforms the whole organism. It changes it. The body itself undergoes change. You know how some people who live the religious life, who succeed in living the religious life in the true sense, live very long. Look at Krishnamurti as an example, living up to 90, nearly 91. And when he was 2 years old, he nearly died of malaria. And he was a sickly child, and so forth. But goodness knows how, he was very gifted from birth onwards in so many ways. He was gifted particularly in that there was no reaction out of him towards anybody or anything or any circumstance. That schoolmaster of his used to thrash him almost every day because he was such a duffer in his subjects. But he had no reaction against the schoolmaster. Now, isn't that a miracle in itself? I mean, how on earth can a child, not knowing as you and I know things and so forth, and can discuss and argue, how is it that that child was like that? No reaction of hate, of violence. And in his fulfillment, he has introduced a vibrating power throughout the world, which will have its own effect as time goes by. Of course, the effect is small, because the human race consists of creatures who are somewhat cussed by nature, and they are always again this, that and the other. This is the result of the uprising of the sense of ego, the separate I am, which produces the great duality, thou and I, and thou art different from, separate from me. You know, all human beings, or practically all human beings, experience what we can say is love, especially between the sexes. If you can really look into the nature of that love, you will find that it is not really love in the transcendent sense. In the transcendent sense, love is an unreserved, total giving of oneself to everyone, to everything. There is no selectiveness. When there is selectiveness, there is possessiveness. My wife, my husband, my child. That sense is very, very strong. Mind you, we have to go through all this. We have to go through it, because by going through it, the human race as a whole begins to see what obstructs human fulfillment and the culmination of human development in the real sense. So we have to. Adam had to sin. He had to disobey God. And it's a jolly good thing that he did. Otherwise you and I wouldn't have got even this far in our existence. And Adam, when I say Adam, don't think of the 4004 BC of Archbishop Usher, 10th of October, 9 a.m. when Adam was, or was it 4th of October? I forget. 9 a.m. I mean, the vicegerents of gods, the self-appointed vicegerents of God and their lieutenants and so on, really have been amongst some of the biggest idiots in the world. The things they have said and done. However, there we are. So, Adam really means he of the ground. That is one meaning, Adam, he of the ground. Now, the ground here doesn't mean the earth on which we stand or sit. The ground, in the metaphysical sense, is the origin. He who was created out of the origin, by the origin. In ordinary language, by God, as we say. I prefer to use the word transcendence, as you know, simply because that word is not so heavily loaded as the word God or Brahman or Atma and so forth. Fancy writing treatises about the nature of the Atma or Brahman or the Buddha nature or anything you like to call it, regarding it as the origin, the source of all things. It's a lot of talk. It can be helpful if we are ready to abstract the essence of the talk and let the talk completely disappear after that. In abstracting the essence, that essence becomes part of our life itself, part of our living process, part of our very consciousness. We become conscious of reality that way. But it isn't an easy thing. And always remember, you can't grasp at it. And you must never try to grasp that truth, or pursue truth, or chase truth, because you will find yourself pursuing your particular thought form of the truth. The mind has to be, the psyche has to be completely open, empty. When that is the case, then the truth will enter you and change you. And it will change the physical, psychophysical organism in such a manner that in course of time, the effect will influence the brain to conceive something which is a step or two further than the conceptions which have already been produced by one's own brain. See, that's how it happens. It has to happen naturally, spontaneously, and that is creative action. Otherwise, it's mere procreative action. Procreative meaning that it is true to type. That is why discipleship has its very great dangers. We try to convert ourselves into the shape of the teacher, the master. We follow the teacher, we obey the teacher. Obey in the wrong sense of the word. Namely, unquestioningly, to carry out what is imposed upon us. No, each one of us is absolutely unique. We have to discover that uniqueness. Don't try to chase it in the process of discovery. Just be quiet and it will emerge. It will emerge. Consider how a child is born. The fertilized ovum is one single cell. One single cell. Look at the process which it goes through inside the womb. A process which neither father nor mother can control. Neither parent can say to that single cell, you grow like this, you do this, you do the other. Cannot be done. It just happens. Mystery. And that is its supreme charm, the magic of it all. See, in the same way, our uniqueness and what we in ourselves really are will just emerge by itself if you let it emerge. Have no ideas, oh, I must become like the Buddha, or follow in the footsteps of Jesus, or whatever you like. Your footstep will never fit into the footprint of the teacher. Never. Your footsteps are your own. So in that sense of uniqueness, you express the true self. The true self, the total self, which is expressing itself through your psychophysical organism. See, it's transcendence all the time, underlying everything. Transcendence is that transcendent substance which lies underlies all manifestation, all growth, all process, all fulfillment, and so on. And when that sort of silence, when you approach that kind of silence, you will experience the true meaning of communion. It is not a communion is usually thought of and talked about as I and my God. You see, two separate things. There never is communion that way. The I is transformed into God, by God. I do nothing apart from keeping the temple clean. That's where the Skanda and the Maitreya Upanishads gave out a wonderful, both of them gave the same statement. The body, meaning the whole psychophysical organism, is the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva, the destroyer regenerator. You see, the birth death process really is embodied in that third person of the Hindu Trinity. In Christianity we have the Holy Ghost. You see, it's put in those terms. But in the idea of Shiva is embodied a colossal reality, truth. The dweller in the temple is Shiva. You or I, we are just the caretakers of this temple. And as caretakers, we have to keep it clean so that there is no defiling influence which would obstruct the transcendent power from suffusing you completely. Well, one paragraph has done all this today. I think we'll have to skip pages. Otherwise, 389 pages will take 389 months. At least.